If you're a smoker or dipper looking to make a change, you really only need one reason to do it. But with Zyn nicotine pouches, you can find many. Zyn is America's number one nicotine pouch. It's made with only 6 simple ingredients. Plus, Zyn is the only nicotine pouch with a 10-day hassle-free trial. There are lots of options when it comes to nicotine satisfaction, but there's only one Zyn. Find your Zyn online or in a store near you at zyn.com/find. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I remember going into, at age 26, 27, going into auditions for like Disney shows to play like 15-year-olds. And there were actually, the room was filled with kids and their parents. And, you know, I was so embarrassed that I would say, oh, you know, my dad dropped me off. You know, he's coming back to pick me up a little bit. Because it was just like, oh my God, it's me and all of these children. And like, I'm a grown man. Hi, I'm Steven Kruger. I am an actor, and I think I'm going to have a new best friend after today.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome. Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Off the Beat. I am your host, Brian Baumgartner. Now, this week's guest, as you just heard, has a lot of buzz around him. Yellow Jacket's very own Steven Kruger is joining me today. Get it? Buzz. Yellow Jacket's like a bee. You get it. I get it. It's awesome. Steven, what can I say about Steven? One, he's very cool. Two, he's worked on a lot of huge shows like The Originals and Roswell, New Mexico, jumping into everything from vampires to sci-fi. Steven has no fear, literally. And that cannot be more true than with his most recent show, Yellow Jackets. If you haven't seen it, you should. It's that good. I really, really enjoyed it. And wow, it could not have been easy to execute. There are time jumps. The cast filmed in freezing temperatures. And spoiler alert, Steven literally got his leg chopped off. Maybe not literally, but that did happen on the show. We'll talk about that and much, much more. I cannot wait for you to hear our conversation. It's a good one. Let's go right now, my South by Southwest buddy, Steven Kruger.
Bubble and squeak, I love it. Bubble and squeak, I know. Bubble and squeak, I cook it every moment left over from the night before.
What's up, Steven?
There he is, the man, the myth, the legend.
What's happening?
Oh, man, it's great to see your face.
Well, it's good to see yours. Now, before we get started, I may meet you in person. Are you going on a little trip this weekend?
Oh, are you going to be in Austin?
Oh, well, maybe we'll see each other in person.
My man, new best friend. Hello.
Hi. Well, we'll have a chat today, and then we'll have, well, maybe a longer chat this weekend.
That sounds amazing. Austin. What are you doing down there?
I'm actually coming to stalk you. I don't know if that is.
I mean, I appreciate you giving me the heads up, honestly,
right off
the, because
right
now off, I can plan a few things just to like keep you on your toes.
Right off the bat, no, I am there in Austin with iHeart talking about this podcast right here. We're gonna do a couple of panels down there at South by Southwest. So anyway,
that's amazing. Wow, I'm so happy you're gonna be there.
This is just part one.
Fantastic.
Of our time together this very week.
Well, we better not blow it then in part one.
No, let's not blow it.
Yeah, I'm going to try.
Yeah, although I can still cancel the flight.
I don't think I can, so I'm locked in.
There you go. Well, actually, I can't either. So I want to go back. I read you were born in Appleton,
yeah,
the great city of Appleton, Wisconsin, before moving down to Sarasota. Now, does that make you a Green Bay Packer fan?
You know, I think I switched allegiances, which is like kind of a cardinal sin, but I think
I've done it.
I think, yeah, I switched allegiances pretty quickly when I got to Florida. I mean, to be fair, people ask me where I grew up and I do say Florida. I do say Sarasota. I think I left Wisconsin when I was like 9 years old.
Okay.
So I do equate growing up with Florida, although it's weird because, you know, 9 years old is kind of that time when it's like split your childhood, right? I mean, it's literally halfway in between being born and leaving for college. But yeah, I think like within a year or two of moving to Florida, I switched allegiances to the Bucks. Because you know, you don't want to be the person in Florida rooting for the Green Bay Packers.
Or you do, but that was a choice you made.
That was a choice I made. You know, Brian, I got bullied enough in high school. I didn't need that added. I didn't need that added element to it there.
All right. Well, that's fair enough. I actually have relatives in Sarasota.
Do you really?
Down there. I do. It's been a number of years since I've been down there. The great area, town, district, Siesta Key down there in Sarasota.
Yeah. Best beach in the country.
Best beach in the country.
Like not my personal opinion. Like Google it.
Rated.
I mean, you could probably ask ChatGPT as well. I don't know. It might give you a slightly different answer, but yeah.
Google's never wrong. so you grew up in Florida. When did you first start thinking, oh, acting sounds kind of fun? Was this something you were interested in early on? Or was this a developed taste?
This was something I was interested in early on, but there's a couple caveats to that. Number one, I actually wasn't interested in it. My mother thought that I would be interested in it. She for whatever reason thought, and it's probably just because I was a little rambunctious and you know, was always kind of running around trying to steal the spotlight, and so she probably just wanted an outlet so that when I came home from school, I would be quiet. So she kind of encouraged when I started high school, she kind of encouraged, you know, why don't you take acting level one and just see what happens? I think you'd love it. And I remember fighting her on it too. I was like, why do I want to, like, no, that sounds terrible. Let me take, you know, like let me take study hall or like gym or something where I can just dick around for an hour.
Right.
And so of course, you know, as the tale always goes, mother knows best. And, I can still remember the exercise and the teacher that we had, she was brilliant. Her name was Terry Wood. She had been in LA for a while, I think done some like soap operas and stuff like that, but she was an incredible acting teacher. And I will never forget the very first day of that first year in high school as a freshman going into acting class. And there was an exercise where we were all on the stage sitting in a circle and she kind of laid out this story for us. And she said, so your parents gave you $100 to come to school with, and that $100, and I forget exactly what the details were, but it was something that really drove the stakes up, right? That $100 was really, really important. It was
important.
Like, you know, it was like to fix, you know, your car at the end of the day, and if you weren't going to pick up your brother, yada, 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 whatever.
Okay.
Very high stakes. And you've now misplaced that $100. You cannot find it. What do you do? And me sitting there, you know, we're all sitting there, we're literally first day of high school. And so I kind of start doing what I think is acting, right? I like start going through my pockets and like starting to look concerned and all this stuff. And meanwhile, I'm like side-eye glancing at the teacher, like, am I doing this right? You know, like, is this what you were going for? Like, how good am I as an actor? And I remember this one guy in the class, I can still picture his face. His name was Chris. And he got up from the stage and went down to his seat in the audience and started tearing through his backpack and throwing things around. And I remember everybody in the class, including myself, just stopped and watched this guy. And immediately, and of course, you know, that was kind of the lesson, right? It's like, yes, that is exactly what she was trying to get us to do. And I just remember being so enthralled with like, oh, like that's what acting is. That was insane. Like this guy just got up and started tearing through. Like I never in a million years would have thought to do something like that. And so it clicked very, very quickly for me. I was like, that's cool. Like I want to learn how to do that. I want to be able to like capture some stranger's attention just by doing something like that. And so, you know, it grew and it became something that I really enjoyed doing. But to be totally honest with you, it was a high school hobby. I mean, Never in a million years did I think I read that you did this in high school, but then also went on to study it in college and got your degree and all that stuff. That was in the back of my mind. You know, when I left high school and went to college, I was going to go to law school. You know, I was never going to be an actor professionally because let's be honest, Brian, who becomes an actor professionally?
Right. Well, law school, to be fair, that was my plan B. So you did plays in high school?
I did plays. And I also, I made a note to ask you about this. I also did competitive speech and debate. I went to
that.
All of the
yes.
tournaments. And did you do the same thing?
Yes. So I saw that note. You,
oh, Brian, we're both such nerds. I love this.
You joined the speech and debate team.
Uh-huh.
You did duo interp. I did, they called it at the time, humorous
interp. Yep.
Interp.
And then there was dramatic interp.
And I did dramatic interp.
I bet you did.
And actually was more successful the year that I went to nationals there for dramatic interp. So you were serious about that. Like you would do that on the weekends. You would go to the competitions.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And we had and my high school had a, like the speech and debate team at my high school was legit. I mean, we were in, I remember it was like two seasons, right? I don't know if you guys did this cause you were in Atlanta, right? So not that far away.
That's right.
We did like in the fall, you know, there weren't like the acting events, the speech. It was more, okay. It was more debate. It was like congressional debate, you know, where we would go to like the state capitol and have these tournaments and stuff. So I would do that in the fall. And then in the spring is when it branched out into all those different categories, right? You guys probably had the same thing where it was like, you know, poetry and prose and like all this different stuff.
Right.
And so, yeah, in the spring, it became, I actually started to prefer that over doing plays in high school. I think because of like the competitive nature of it, you know, like I also played tennis and so there was just like this competitive itch in me. And I was like, yes, I want to act, but I also want to beat people at acting. And so, yeah, I did duo interpretation. And then like once in a while, my partner wouldn't be available for a tournament. So I would like jump into humorous or dramatic or something like that. And, I mean, it was a blast. Like it was looking back on it, it really was like the nerdiest possible medium for acting, you know, like,
right.
Like the rules and just kind of like the stiffness of it all in duo interpretation. I don't know if you ever saw it, but like you weren't actually allowed to look at your partner. It was like, you were both facing out towards the back of the room. And it's like, you picked like a spot on the back of the room. And that was like, you know, like you were looking at your partner, but it was all facing out to the audience.
Yes. Yes. I have seen it before.
You know, it was really fun. I mean, it truly was like, it was a good time in the nerdiest acting dork kind of way right. possible.
Right. Well, it's interesting because, so I, like you, it sounds, am a very competitive person and started in sports. So I think there was something about me that really got off on that as well. Like, but what's funny for me is that not the interp stuff, but the competition stuff continues through college. There's a competition, acting competition called the Irene Ryans. I don't know how I just pulled that out.
That is impressive.
And we did like the one act play competitions. We went and won the national one act play comp, and it was all about that. And then I went to college. I went to SMU, and the person who was head of the acting program there specifically said, no. We're not doing that. That's not act. We're here to actually learn the process of acting. Which
God, what a buzzkill.
I know, which is so it's funny now. Like at the time, at the time I was like, oh no, that's a very reasonable approach. I'm here just to learn. I'm here just to learn. But now I'm like, God, I wish I could have crushed this person.
People took it so seriously. I'm sure you remember. Yeah. Like it was like I will never forget being at those tournaments and like And like, I don't know if they did it this way when you were there, and we can move on from high school speech and debate after this, I swear.
Or not.
Or not. We could just do an entire hour on this.
Yes.
Maybe this is a separate podcast that we need to explore. You know, sometimes I do wonder, like, if kids are still doing this in high school. I'm sure that they are. But like, I remember being in those tournaments, and it was like you would do your initial few rounds or whatever, and then like they would put up like a big poster board that just had your team number or your competitor number written on it. And it was like, if you broke onto the next round, then your number would be on the board. So everybody kind of sat around, like, just, you know, biting their fingernails, and they'd put up this thing, and everybody would rush up to the board and like, oh my God, I'm on there. And then, you know, if your number wasn't on there, you were just crushed. And it would just go like that until you got to the final round where it was like, you know, six people or six teams were on that thing.
That is so funny that you say that, because I remember that. It feels like, and you're younger than I am, but it feels like 1972 or something, where like everyone is standing around waiting for a piece of paper to get taped to the wall. I know the internet existed when you were growing, when you were doing this. Now I wonder if that drama is gone.
It's probably an app, you know, you probably get like a notification on an app, and it's exactly. Like, you know, you're off. But the exciting part about it was that there was a community, you know, and like, though it was competitive, like when you got to those later rounds of the competition, all the people that had been like eliminated, you know, previously would come and watch. So all of a sudden, you know, before it was just the teams you were competing against in the room. Now you get to like the quarterfinals, the semifinals, the finals. Now you've got huge rooms full of people that have just come to watch because it's entertaining. And like, That's kind of my first sense of like, you know, outside of high school plays, performing for people, you know, in a very real, like, live setting. And it was, I mean, it's exhilarating.
And how was that for you? Did you get a high from that?
Oh my God, completely.
Performing in front of people.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I absolutely loved it. That, I mean, especially doing comedy, as you know, it's like you get that, you know, you launch in, and that first 30, 45 seconds comes the first joke, and you can tell right then if this is going to go well or not. You know, if it's crickets in the room, all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, I have 9 more minutes of this, and this is going to be a disaster. But like, if there's a big laugh on that first joke, it's like, let's go. Here, we got this.
I read you did 15 years of competitive tennis. Now, I was a tennis player as well, and I could say the same thing. Something tells me you were a little bit more serious than I was. This was,
that's only because I grew up in Florida. I mean, okay. Florida was like ground zero for the hyper competitive, mostly douchey, you know, young people growing up who were being coached by their parents and going to all the fancy academies and whatnot. I mean, because you could play year round, of course. So
did you go to a fancy academy?
You know, I started at one, and I think it
Not
was a combination
Nick Bollettieri.
It was Nick Bollettieri.
Nick Bollettieri. I didn't do that research. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I went to Nick Bollettieri. I was there. I worked there for, let's see, I think I trained there for like, it wasn't long. It was like 2 months or something. And then I think I realized very quickly that I wasn't good enough to actually be getting coached by Nick himself. You know, that was of course reserved for like the, you know, Andy Roddick was only like a few years ahead of me. So I remember he was like a big thing growing up, and like, it was people at that level, you know, people that were clearly about to be professional tennis players. And I was like, well, you know, this is kind of stupid. I'm like being trained by these. So I ended up going to a smaller one called Billy Stearns. And yeah, I mean, I played in high school. I eventually gave up all my other sports to kind of focus on tennis. And I played year round, you know, would train during the summer, Florida summers, of course, when they would let you be on the court for about 10 minutes at a time. And then you would, you know, a mandated break for 5 minutes. So it was just like constant back and forth. But I mean, I loved it. It was, you know, there was nothing better to me. I don't know where I got this competitive, you know, drive from, but I guess in theory it served me well.
Well, it's interesting because tennis, and I assume you played singles.
I did singles and doubles, yeah.
And you did doubles. So that's kind of like the duo thing. You're choosing these competitive outlets that are usually done solo, but you're choosing to have a partner. Now, for you, that competition continued to drive you through college, and you wanted to go to law school?
I guess, although I didn't really do anything competitive other than like, you know, pledge a fraternity, which I guess was like kind of competitive, you know, like got to get into the best frat, of course.
Right.
But no, I mean,
Wahoo, wah.
You know it, huh?
Yeah, I know it.
Yeah.
You Virginia people, you're so smug about Virginia.
Are we really?
Let me just tell you. You know, what I kept hearing when I went to SMU was that it was built the design was exactly the same as Virginia.
No way.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
So it's like, like the lawn and like all the pavilions and all that stuff.
The dome,
the big,
the hilltop,
the rotunda. We call it a rotunda, Brian.
Rotunda. So did we.
You know where a lot of that smugness came from? It's like we didn't, you know, UVA, we don't call it a campus. It's called grounds. If you say campus, you will be chastised. And then, of course, we don't call it freshman, sophomore, junior, senior. It was first, second, so third, stupid. Fourth year.
Yeah, so stupid. That's the
you know, I know it's stupid, but I'm an alumni, and I'm still like, you know what? That's what we do. I'm sorry. This is how we roll.
It's like the Ohio State University. There's a similar smugness and douchery that is associated with both of that. I'm going to get hell from my Virginia friends.
You're
going to
get a lot of emails about that.
But
two schools after you now.
Yeah. Look. By the way, love both schools. They are fantastic.
Fantastic universities.
Universities of higher learning.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turned sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So you go to university. You were just on the law school track.
I studied government. I studied history. I studied economics. In no sense did I ever even consider. I didn't even take a class. I mean, at that point, acting was completely in my past. I was like, yeah, cool, that was fun in high school. Now let's move on to, like, you know, grown up things.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when did it change?
So it changed because, I mean, it's funny. I often think that, like, my entire career was a complete coincidence because I graduated from school and I had this plan where, like, I wanted to take a couple of years off before I went to law school. I don't know why. I think at the time I realized that, like, you know, law school is and the career track of a lawyer is an interesting thing. It's like, once you go to law school, you're kind of stuck on that path because you've got to graduate from law school and then immediately take the bar. You know, it's not like you can graduate from law school and then take the bar 2 years later.
Right.
You'll fail. And then once you take the bar, you kind of have to get a job. You know, you got to go to a law firm and start your career. You know, again, if you take the bar and then take 2 years off, nobody's going to hire you. So right. I kind of intuitively knew that at that age. And I was like, if I'm ever going to take time off, this is the time to do it. And I had gotten an internship at this law firm in LA. And it was supposed to be for, like, recent undergraduates, you know, who were either about to start law school or going to start law school sometime in the next year or two. So I came out for that. It was, you know, it was an exciting thing. You had to apply to get it. And it was a big fancy corporate law firm, which is exactly what I thought I wanted to do. So I found myself in LA for this summer. And long story short, I mean, I kind of just got a bitter taste in my mouth from working at this law firm. I was, you know, I saw a lot of partners at this law firm who were in their 50s and 60s, and they just weren't, you know, I mean, they would be very honest with me in these little meetings that we would have where they said, you know, I put it bluntly, I've got a lot of money, you know, like I make a lot of money, but I'm divorced and I don't know my kids that well. And I'm 60 years old and I still work 65 or 70 hours a week. And it was a lot of that, you know, and I was just like, is this really, you know, I don't know if this is actually what I want to do. I thought about maybe, you know, being a judge and, like, doing constitutional law, but, you know, you don't make very much money doing that. And I do like money. So, you know, that was always in the back of my mind. So I basically, after that internship ended, I said, you know what? I loved acting in high school. I'm in LA. This is where it all happens. Why not just, like, try that for a couple of years, you know, in that interim 2 years off and see what happens. And if nothing happens, then, you know, no harm, no foul. That was my plan anyway. I go to law school as intended. And that plan quickly got shot down, which now it's so funny because what an idiot, like what a dumbass I was, you know, isn't it funny when we're like 22 years old and we're like, yeah, no, I've got this all, like, I know what I'm doing. I got this figured out. This is easy. But I had a meeting with, a producer named Brad Fuller, who is, I mean, he's a huge producer. Even at that time, he was, you know, a big producer. He was Michael Bay's partner and been doing this for a long time. And he's a family acquaintance. And so they, you know, kind of set this up and he was gracious enough to sit down with this, you know, 22-year-old kid for honestly an hour. I don't know why, but I told him this plan and he kind of laughed in my face, honestly. And he said, okay. Not to shit on your dreams or anything, but if your plan is to try this for a couple of years and see what happens, then don't bother. You know, this is not the kind of industry, this is not the kind of career where you can try it for 2 years and see what happens, because nothing's going to happen. Like, I promise you that. And so I almost remember my face, like, melting, you know, like trying to like not cry because I thought I had this all figured out. And then this guy is just, like, turning my whole plan upside down. And I remember asking him, well, okay, not 2 years, like how long, 3 years, 4 years? And he flat out told me 10 years. He said, you need 10 years to figure out a few things, right? And you'll relate to this, right? You need 10 years to figure out, A, if you even like it. You know, a lot of times we do this as younger kids and we think, oh, this is so fun. And then we start doing it professionally. And it's like, no, this is not nearly as fun as it was as a kid. He said, you need to know if you're any good at it, because same thing, you know, everybody thinks you're good when you're a kid. And then you start doing it as an adult and they're like, nope, not actually that good at this. And then, of course, if you can deal with, like, the ups and the downs, right, the roller coasters. And he said, you won't know any of that really until you're about 10 years in. And funny enough, I would give the exact same advice to somebody now. I mean, do you agree?
Yeah, it's interesting. I have sort of a similar theory, which is that the people who live in New York or they live in Chicago or they live in London or wherever else, and they come to LA for a pilot season. Mm-hmm. This, for me, never made sense. Now, it works out.
Yeah.
Somehow, for some people, it works out. But for me, yeah, that...
Well, it worked out back when there was a pilot season.
Well, that's... For one, that's true. But Yeah, just the idea that I'm just going to go to LA and try this for a couple of months and see. Because the likelihood that, one, you're going to get a pilot is not great. And then, two, that that pilot is going to get made. And then, three, that it's going to turn into a series. Right. Like, I agree.
So many things have to go right.
Yeah, you have to play. For me, you had to play the long game, which was why I never came until I was ready to move.
Smart.
I mean, here's the point. It is a business. It is a business. It's not a flight of fancy. I mean, you know, it is, you sort of mentioned this, it's kind of a young person's game, right? You have the energy, you have the ability to, you know, the desire to sleep on someone's sofa for a period of time and be sort of a-okay with that. But I think approaching it as a business and taking that long-term 10 years, whatever that number is exactly right.
Yeah. And I mean, and the funny thing is it literally was a young person's game for me because I, you know, the second piece of the advice that I got from Brad was, you know, he then said, okay, look, if you decide you want to do this, did you study this in college? I said, well, no. He said, so you're telling me you just did some plays in high school? I was like, yeah, more or less. The ridiculousness that I was presenting to this like established producer, it still haunts me to this day. like truly, it gives me nightmares. But he said, well, look, you probably need to spend some time like studying, going back to school, like learning how to do this. You know, don't rush out and try to get an agent and a manager and try to start auditioning. You know, this is a cutthroat business. You will walk into a casting office, and if you're not up to snuff, they will take a big black marker and just cross off your name, which is true. I mean, I learned that the hard way once or twice. I mean, to this
day. That is very true.
Yeah.
Yeah. People think, well, I'll just give it a shot. What, you know, what's the harm in going and giving it a shot? And if you're not prepared, you know, everybody is doing their own job within this business.
Right.
And it is a business for them. So you get somebody to convince a casting director or a producer to have you seen on a show when there are thousands of people who want to be seen on this show.
And or even seen in an audition.
Seen in an audition.
Back in the day when we were going into a room and they only had, you know, 30, 40 spots to see people.
That's right. Seen for a show, I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you waste their time. Oh, you'll never walk back in there again.
To this day, I have a casting director or two that will not see me. Like truly to this day, it's remarkable, but it does exactly what you just said. It makes a lot of sense. And I mean, he kind of scared the shit out of me. So I really did spend a few years just studying and training. You know, it's not like I went back to college or anything, but just with different teachers around town. And I really took that seriously. You know, I kind of treated it like graduate school, even though it, you know, much less expensive, of course. And, you know, so it wasn't really until I was in my mid-20s easily that I was even like trying to go out on auditions, you know? So I really got a late jump on all of this. And it was funny because I still looked so young. I mean, I still, you know, I get rid of this and be like, oh my God, you could probably play college age still. Right. But like, I remember going into at age 26, 27, going into auditions for like Disney shows to play like 15-year-olds. And there were, you know, the room was filled with kids and their parents. And, you know, I was so embarrassed that I would say, oh, you know, my dad dropped me off. You know, he's coming back to pick me up a little bit. Because it was just like, oh my God, it's me and all of these children. And like, I, you know, I'm a grown man. I remember playing high school when I was 30 years old and thinking like, okay, I think this is it. I think this is my last opportunity to play high school. Because at a certain point, you just like, you know, mentally, you forget what it was like to be in high school and be able to portray that. But that's always kind of been my path, I think, in this industry. Is I was on the late track, you know. I didn't start until later in life, and I still look young, so I kind of have this weird like dichotomy that I've always been wrestling with.
So when did you finally have the confidence that you were ready to start going out for shows?
I mean, it happened. I'm not sure there was any one moment. I remember a young woman in one of my acting classes that I worked with a few times said, hey, you know, do you have a manager or an agent or anything? And she ended up setting me up with her manager. And that kind of fell through after a short amount of time. And then I got another manager that I was with for a very long time. And I guess it just kind of started slowly happening. We're like this audition and this audition. And then you book a little co-star where it's like, I mean, I'll still remember for the rest of my life that very first co-star that I got that was two lines. And I remember getting the call and thinking, I'm going to be on television. Like, I'm going to actually be paid to be on television. This is the best moment of my life. And it was, you know, it was like one or two lines on a CW show. And I just thought it was like the coolest, you know, the coolest thing ever. And I mean, you know how careers go. Like, they, you know, you slowly kind of build and you book some small parts. And I do remember there being, well, there were a couple moments. There was one after I had done a number of guest stars, that show Pretty Little Liars came out, and it was like kind of a big deal. And I had never read the books or anything. I didn't really know about it, but I remember getting it and starting to like research it. And I remember thinking like, oh, this is like a thing. Like, the people that are on this show as regulars are going to be, you know, they're going to be famous. Like, they're going to be big deals. And I did like three episodes at the very beginning of the show, but that was kind of my first taste of like I remember my manager telling me how much money I was going to make. And it was like, it was nothing, you know, but like, I remember thinking, what? Like, in for 1 week, I'm going to make that much money? Like, holy shit, this is incredible. Like, wow. And like the scripts got delivered to my house by like a courier, you know, because I had to be at the table read the next day. And I was like, hello, like, I am all right. It's like, we are getting somewhere now.
It's so funny because, yeah, I mean, that experience of like, wow, this is what I'm getting paid. But then it's like, oh, right. But I haven't worked in 3 months.
And I won't work for 3 months after this, at least.
Right. So take that 1 week and spread that over 3 months. And you're like, oh, right.
Yeah. I was like immediately doing the math. I'm like, great. This much per week times 52 weeks a year. I'm rich. I am right. Like, this is awesome. And then it's like, no. You will be back to unemployed in about 3 weeks.
Yeah. Your mind's like, wait, why is my car still at the tow yard? I don't understand. I thought I was getting paid all this money.
Man. But yeah, I mean, that happened. And then, you know, I did go through a trough, and I remember this. I've talked about this before. I think the year was 2012, and I had done, you know, I had been working for a couple of years at that point pretty consistently on, you know, guest stars and things like that, some recurring roles, and money, you know, some money was coming in. I did some commercials back in the day. I remember commercials were like a big thing. And,
yes,
you know, you could actually make a living doing just commercials. You know, you would, yes, do one national commercial, and, you know, all of a sudden 60, 80, 100 grand was showing up in your mailbox with residuals. It was mind blowing to me. But like, I was starting to kind of feel it. But then for whatever reason, I wasn't getting the bigger roles, you know, like I would go out and audition for them and I would get called back and like, you know, I would get down to like maybe the last two or three people, and it wasn't happening. And like, you know who I always heard talking about this, and I someday I will meet him and I will thank him for giving me hope, was John Hamm, because I hear him, you know, every time people talk to him and interview him. You've talked to him, actually, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know him, obviously. But like, he always talks about that, you know, he was getting close and just never getting the thing. And I remember reading at some point, he tested for 15 or 17 pilots, and he was, you know, 35 years old when he got Mad Men. And he specifically was somebody that I held on to as like, okay, it's not too late. Like, I'm like, this is actually how it's supposed to go. You know, like, I had an acting coach named John Rosenfeld that I worked with for a long time. I'm still very close with. He had a great quote that I really took to heart, that I think every actor should take to heart. He said, booking is a mistake. Booking a job is a mistake. It's truly an accident, because it oftentimes has nothing to do with the audition that you're doing, you know, with the work that you're doing. It's a million other reasons that go into it, you know, that we have no control over. He said, the thing you can control is getting yourself in contention. If you're good and you're doing good work and you put yourself in a position to be one of those last few, you know, in the mix, that's the best that you can hope for. And then beyond that, don't worry about it. Like, things will start happening at some point. And so those were kind of the things that I took to heart. And I thought, you know what, this will happen at some point. Just keep, I was also a psychopath, by the way, when it came to like researching and preparing it. Like, I know a lot of actors, I feel like most actors, I'm curious what you think about this. If I would audition for something, I would then look up exactly when that episode of television was going to air, and I would record it and I would watch it. And I would say, who got this part and what did they do differently from me? Why did they get that part and I did not? Like, I needed to know. And it was religious. Like, every single, and I still do it to this day, believe it or not. Every single thing I audition for that I don't get, I watch because I'm like, what motherfucker got this thing and what did they do that was better than me? And I know so many actors that are like, once they leave that audition room, they're just like, forget it. Don't want to think about it. Don't want to know who got it. Don't want to watch it or anything like that. But the advantage I think that gave me and what was really helpful about that was I oftentimes saw they didn't do anything better than me. You know, like either they did something very similar to what I did, or to be quite honest, they were like not quite as good as what I thought I did. And there was some other reason that they got hired. Now, of course, once in a while, you do see that thing where you're like, oh shit. Yeah, that person's really good. But then you still learn from it, right? You're like, wow, right. I would not have thought to take this role or this material in that direction. So it's super educational. And I think that actually helped me quite a bit. I don't know if you ever reached that level of sociopathy, but
I was a sociopath about researching the show, you know, the genre, the style, before going in. I think the only thing that I will do now.
here it comes. You know,
if I'm going to admit it, is if there's something that I'm really interested in now and I know that I'm in the mix for, and it doesn't happen, I will demand to know who got it
and where they live
and pray that they are 5'5" and 125 pounds. Like,
yep.
If you know, when it comes, and God, I think this happened one time, God bless him. I was a big fan of him as a person and as an actor, but like if Leslie Jordan got it instead of me, then I'm like, totally cool. That's totally fine. They were looking yes. for something else. I felt like my version was okay.
Yep.
But there you go.
That's how I am. It's like I get something or I come close to something and then like I see Idris Elba got it. And I'm just like, yeah, yeah. Well, sure. Of course. So that's they were looking for Idris Elba. No, that's obviously never happened, but that would be a dream.
Oh, that's funny. But then it's like, and I know him a little bit too, but if you know John Carroll Lynch, when I see John Carroll Lynch got it, I was like, well, fuck, I just screwed it up. I clearly just screwed it up.
It's like your doppelganger gets the role.
Yeah, exactly.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now? Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, the story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In 2013, you finally get a significant role. The Originals, the role of Josh. Mm-hmm. Now, had you seen Vampire Diaries before?
I hadn't, but of course I had heard of it. You know, everybody had heard of it at that point. I hadn't watched it. I had auditioned for The Originals for like the backdoor pilot that they did in one of the seasons of Vampire Diaries, and I didn't get that.
Okay.
And then once the series got picked up and they called me in for this other role, that was, you're right, that was kind of like my first, I would call it like maybe significant real break, but it wasn't supposed to be.
Right.
It was supposed to be, which I found out later, and I didn't even realize this. I kind of had an instinct, but I thought that it was supposed to be like three episodes. You know, they even told me like, you know, you're written in three episodes. Maybe it goes to four, you know, maybe they extend you a little bit. And then I got there and I started doing this role, and I don't know, something just kind of clicked, you know, whether it was, you know, I'm sure it was a combination of like the work I was doing and the character itself was just something that they kind of needed on the show. You know, it kind of filled a gap on the show, but you know, that three or four episodes turned into five seasons and my first series regular. And that was when I first felt like, oh, something I'm doing is at least having an impact on the work that I'm getting, you know, like they saw that I was doing something and they decided to keep this character around for five seasons. And that was a good feeling. You know, that was the first time in my career where I was like, great, I think that I can do this and actually make a living. You know, that was the first time I didn't have a side job. You know, the first time I was just living on acting, which I think every actor remembers, you know, that first year where, oh my gosh, I just survived off of what I was making as an actor. So that was a really cool moment. And the cool thing about that show, the writer's room in the first season of that show, of like the 10 writers, I think eight or nine of them have now been showrunners and creators, which is just insane. You know, like they were all such talented writers, and so much credit to our showrunners who were Julie Plec and Michael Narducci for like handpicking this group of people that were just insanely talented. And a lot of them, it was, you know, their first or second job in a writer's room. And all of these people were brilliant. So I knew that those scripts I was getting, I was like, this is good. Like, this is impressive. You know, it's a CW vampire show, but like, this is really, really good stuff. And it made me want to like dive in even further, you know, it made me want to take it really seriously and really kind of dig into the work. And lo and behold, that's how I got Yellow Jackets. So, you know, things like that tend to work out.
You played a gay character, Josh, mm-hmm. on television before gay marriage was even legalized.
Yeah.
Did you feel any sort of responsibility about that? Was there any added pressure on that? It was a positive representation.
Yes. Yes. Very, very positive. I turned down the audition twice before I went in and actually did it, because, and this was my own, you know, stupid bias and prejudice at the time, but for whatever reason, I was reading the sides and I was reading the breakdown, and I had it in my head that they wanted kind of a flamboyant, you know, very two-dimensional gay character for this role. And I thought, well, A, that's not something I want to play. And B, that's not me, you know, like somebody's going to be able to pull that off much better than I can, you know?
Right.
And once they told me, you know, no, this, the whole point of this gay character is he is a normal college guy. he's got a whole lot of stuff going on. And oh yeah, he happens to be gay as well. And I thought, well, that's cool. Like that's something that you don't see on TV. I mean, this was 2013 and you didn't see that on TV a whole lot. You know, it was like you would have token characters that were diverse or minorities, whether it was, you know, sexuality, ethnicity, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And so I thought, okay, well, here's a chance to take a character and have him be entirely three-dimensional. And his sexuality is just one of his personality traits, you know, as are humans. So it was like a really well-rounded three-dimensional character. And I thought this is a really cool opportunity. So yeah, I did. I felt a huge responsibility to kind of make the character whole, you know, and not just have it be, hey, here's our gay character on the show. We've seen that so often and it's terrible.
It's interesting because it, you know, it's very similar in a way to, you know, my long conversations with Oscar Nunez, mm-hmm. who played Oscar Martinez on The Office. Yeah. And that was, it, you know, that's the thing that he talks about all the time as well, which, I mean, specifically for his character, you know, he was two seasons in before he knew that his character was gay.
Right.
And he talks about having this conversation in his head, which was like, how does this change me? How does this change my performance? And ultimately landing on the genius of it, which was like, well, nothing,
right.
Idiot.
Right.
This is just a part of who he is. And there is specifically nothing.
And it's a part that hasn't that been explored be on screen yet.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. So I find that very interesting. So when your time on the originals ends fairly quickly, you get cast in Roswell, New Mexico, also on the CW. Now, do you feel like there was a connection there between your work on the originals and then moving on to another show there on the CW?
Yeah, well, there was. And what's funny is timeline wise, Roswell actually came after Yellow Jackets. It was a really weird. So here's what happened. I'm about to blow your mind.
Okay.
So the originals ends in 2018. I kind of bounce around and you know, do, you know, a handful of guest stars and stuff. And again, I go through one of those periods where I'm like, well, shit, maybe I just got lucky with, you know, with that one show. And that was it for me. You know, isn't it weird? Like the mind games that we play right. ourselves, like, right. you know, I just worked for 5 years, but it's probably never going to happen again.
Right.
And so then in 2019, in like the fall of 2019, the script for Yellow Jackets came into my inbox. And Roswell had already been on the season for like, or been on the air for like one season, I think at this point. Roswell was created by one of our writers in that first season of the originals. Her name's Karina okay. McKenzie. And I was very close with her. And I auditioned for a role in Roswell, didn't get it. And then Yellow Jackets came along. And when the script came into my inbox and I read it, I knew it was going to be good because Ashley and Bart wrote it, but I didn't know it was going to be that good. I read it and was... I think every actor on the show says the same thing. It was one of, if not the best pilot I had ever read. It was mind blowing. So I auditioned for that, got that, and we filmed the pilot of Yellow Jackets at the end of 2019, like November and December of 2019.
Oh, wow.
And I remember rapping on the pilot and we were all kind of curious, like, you know, because this was Showtime, I had never done a, you know, like a premium kind of network show like that. And so we were all kind of asking, you know, what's the timeline here? And the answer we got was, oh, by, you know, by March or so, maybe April, we'll have a pickup decision, March or April of 2020.
Right.
So of course we all know what happens. Shit hits the fan, you know, COVID attacks, the entire industry shuts down. And what's so funny is I remember signing the contract for that pilot, and they had a 12-month option on all of the actors. And I had never signed a contract that had that long of an option. And I remember asking my reps at the time, I said, is this normal? Like a whole year? Like they own me for a whole year? And they said, yeah, you know, for like the kind of premium level, you know, networks and stuff, this is what they do. But don't worry, like that's never, you know, they're never gonna take a whole year to decide whether to pick the show up. Like it'll be pretty quick. Yeah. Oh man. So we essentially spent all of 2020 just wondering if the show was going to get picked up, you know, and I would have frequent conversations with Ashley and Bart about, you know, what's going on behind the scenes, and you know, nobody knew. I mean, you remember, it was like networks were kind of going through and nobody knew what the future of the business was. I remember thinking like, sure. Are robots just going to take over? Like, are they just going to do animation, you know, from here on out? And there's not going right. to be any live action stuff. And in the meantime, you know, all of the brilliant minds in the industry kind of formed that like think tank almost, where it was like, how do we get things back? You know, how do we get back onto a set with the proper protocols and all that kind of stuff? And by July, August, September, they had kind of started to figure it out. And so things were starting to get back to production in like September, October of 2020. And Roswell was going back to work. And there was like a one season role on that show. And they called me and said, hey, you know, do you want to play this role? Because I had worked with them for so long. It was Karina McKenzie and Chris Hollier, another writer on the originals. And I said, yes, I would love to, but I don't know what the hell is happening with Yellow Jackets. Like, I don't know if we're getting picked up. So we had to do a whole back and forth with Showtime about like, hey, what is the deal here? Like, is this like, I have an opportunity to go to a full season of another show. Is this thing happening or not? And so I was able to do the full season of Roswell from like October 2019 to April of 2021. And then I had 3 days from when I wrapped Roswell to drive from Santa Fe, New Mexico to Vancouver, Canada to start Yellow Jackets. So it was intense, but I was able to squeeze them both in and I'm very grateful. It was just one of those magical things where the timing just kind of worked out absolutely perfectly, which doesn't happen all that often in this business, as you know.
No, that's awesome. Yellow Jackets, obviously one of the most talked about shows last year. I loved it. So this was, though, a straight audition. Like you got Yellow an Jackets audition was. For it.
Yep. Okay. And it was many rounds. It was many rounds of auditions as well. They put me through the ringer for sure.
Well, I know a lot of things can be faked. There are things on that show that cannot. It is incredibly physically grueling, I imagine, psychologically grueling as well. A lot of stuff taking place outdoors in the woods in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. How was that, the process of shooting? Is that the most difficult show just physically and emotionally that you've done to this point?
Yeah. Yeah, far and away it was. And there were a lot of different elements that went into it. And I'll give, it's not really a spoiler because it happened so early on, but I think the thing you were alluding to is my leg getting chopped off, which happens very, very early on in the show. So not too much of a spoiler. And you know what, if you haven't seen it, that should make you want to go watch it even more.
Right.
But yeah, and they had told me that was going to happen, that I was going to, you know, that I was going to be losing a leg. And, you know, immediately, again, it comes back to very similar with the originals, where it's like, oh wow, so now I'm playing an amputee, and I felt an incredible amount of responsibility there, you know, to really research and figure out how do I do this, you know, as a non-disabled person, how do I authentically represent somebody who has suffered through a traumatic amputation like this. So I did a ton of research, you know, physically, psychologically, what a person goes through just leading up to it. And then we get to Vancouver and the other element of this, yes, you mentioned all of it, right? We were outside in the woods. We were coming in every day and we were putting on our costumes that were dirty and crusty and smelly, that they didn't wash intentionally because we were stranded out in the wilderness and we did not have laundry machines. You know, it was just gross. I mean, we were rolling around in the dirt. It was hot. And then the other element to all of this was the border between the Canada and the US was closed for most of 2021. So we got there and we couldn't leave. We were stuck. We couldn't come back home. We couldn't visit our friends or family. Nobody could come visit us. And so that was like a whole other element that just, I don't think anybody was anticipating. I think we thought that this was, you know, the COVID thing was going to be kind of over by then. But we spent almost that entire first season with nobody but each other. It was very right. much like life imitating art. You know, we were stranded there together. And so the silver lining, I guess, with all of it is that because we only had each other, it really did create this very strong bond and a lot of chemistry amongst the cast for that first season, which I think was kind of reflected, you know, on screen. But it was a strange situation. I mean, none of us knew what to do. You know, we all went through periods of feeling like we were losing our minds. And then, of course, it's the first season of a show, you know, which, as you know, it's hard to know if it's going to be good or not. Like,
right.
Like, did you know, I'm always curious, but I'll be honest, I didn't think that.
Okay.
There were times when I thought, oh wow, like this is going to be good. And I knew that the scripts that we were getting were good, but there was so much self-doubt. All of us went through periods of like, wow, this show is not going to be good. Like, right. This show is not going to find an audience. People are not going to like this. I remember asking my agents and managers, like, in the last month or two of filming, I said, start looking for something else because this might get canceled. which just sounds so stupid in retrospect. But you just don't know. I mean, I'm always curious with other actors. Did you know that The Office was going to be what it was when you guys were doing that first season in those first few episodes?
No. I mean, I knew it was special, but the phrase that I remember saying at the time was, if people give this show a chance, we have the opportunity to do something really special.
Right.
But I, you know, of course I had no idea.
Right.
I mean,
right.
But the elements that you bring up, and to give people some perspective on this, you were forced to essentially be locked in a hotel room for 2 weeks. Is that right?
Yeah, it was 2 weeks.
Two weeks. So folks, you fly into the Canada, and this is what I was told. At first, I thought they locked the door. They don't lock the door, but they don't give you a key to the room. Was this your experience? And so if you leave your room, they'll know because you won't be able to get back in. And on this show, yeah, I see how that could really help. That's got to have created an incredible bond.
It did. I mean, in great ways. And I mean, you know, there were times when we clashed, of course, and would get in arguments and hated each other. But
great for the show.
It was. It really was. Yes. But for a cast as big as we had, I was amazed at how well we all got along. Like truly, like it could have gone very south under those circumstances, and it just didn't. Like we all just got along very, very well. And you know, it's funny, the quarantine thing, I realized afterwards that I did it incorrectly. I'm probably like about to admit to a crime here that they may come and like prosecute me for. But like the two elements that you mentioned, one, you only had to do the hotel if you flew into the country, and I drove into the country. So I got to go straight to my condo that I had rented for like the next 6 months and quarantine there, which most of the people did, but they would have to do 3 days in a hotel to start. And then they got to transfer to their, you know, condo or apartment or whatever they were renting.
Okay.
The second thing I screwed up was I didn't realize you weren't literally were not allowed to walk out your front door. I thought you like couldn't leave and go out on the street. So every day I was like going down to get food deliveries. I would like exercise by like running up and down the stairwell in the building. And then like, I would like run up the stairwell and then take the elevator back down and like run up it again and I get out of quarantine. And like, I'm talking to all my castmates who look like they have just like, you know, spent 2 weeks in the hole in Shawshank Redemption.
Right.
They're like, oh my God, that was brutal. I, you know, one person couldn't get food delivered. She was living on like rice that was like left over from the previous tenants. And I'm like, I didn't think it was that bad. Like, I don't know. I was like, I exercised a lot. I was running up and down the stairs. I got food delivered. I came down and said, what's up? And they're like, what? We got yellow caution tape taped over our doors so we couldn't leave. And I was like, oh, I did this very, very incorrectly.
Oh my gosh.
I'm sorry, Canada.
Sorry, Canada.
Sorry,
wow.
Canada.
Well, good for you though.
I mean, you know, you got to do what you got to do.
It's not a crime if you don't get caught.
And I think the statute of limitations is well passed.
Yeah. Dude, season two coming out very soon here, March 26th. You probably can't give me any spoilers, but what happens?
You want me to just tell you how it ends? You want me to tell you who dies and who lives? You have to promise to not tell anybody.
All right, I won't tell anybody.
Okay, great. It can be a very tall order to come back for a second season after you've done a first season of a show that has the kind of success that we were able to find and we were lucky enough to find. And I think the unique thing about our show is it was a hit with both, you know, kind of critics and audiences. So I think we all felt the weight of those expectations, you know, throughout the entire season. I think that the writers and the creators did an incredible job of pushing the envelope just far enough so that it's not exactly the same as season one, you know, like it's a new vibe. It's even crazier. It's even more intense, but it doesn't jump the shark. You know, it's all rooted in the base of this story and who these people are. It's just putting these people in the most dire of circumstances and seeing how they react. And you know, the result is pretty shocking. It's insane. I mean, it's actually insane. Even filming it, there were moments when we were like, are we really doing this? Are we sure about this?
And that's what you call a tease, ladies and gentlemen. Stephen, thank you so much. I look forward to continuing our blossoming new friendship down in the great state of Texas. March 26, Yellow Jackets comes back. I can't wait. Although this is what I'm gonna get the advanced tapes.
Oh, you are?
That's my goal now.
We don't actually give the tapes out. We have to lock you in a room and you're allowed to view them. And then we use one of those little Men in Black flashy things on you before you leave the room.
Well, then I can see it twice.
Yeah, there
I can
you go.
Enjoy it twice.
Yeah.
Stephen, thank you so much. I'll see you soon.
Thank you, Brian. This was so much fun. I cannot wait to explore our best friendship in Austin, Texas.
That sounds great. Wear some boots.
Will do.
Stephen, thank you so much for joining me today. You're the greatest. I cannot wait for this next season of Yellow Jackets coming March 26th. Buzz, buzz, buzz. Though I am a little mad, you will give me no spoilers. Listeners, make sure to watch the show and then come back here next week for another episode of Off the Beat. The guest, well, yeah, there will be one. Off the Beat is hosted and executive produced by me, Brian Baumgartner, alongside our executive producer, Ling Lee. Our senior producer is Diego Tapia. Our producers are Liz Hayes, Hannah Harris, and Emily Carr. Our talent producer is Ryan Papa Zachary, and our intern is Sammy Katz. Our theme song, Bubble and Squeak, performed by the one and only Creed Bratton.
The journey to a smoke-free future can be a long and winding road, but if you're ready for a change, consider taking Zyn for a spin. Zyn nicotine pouches offer a fresh way to discover your nicotine satisfaction. Anywhere, anytime. No smoke, no spit, and no lingering odor. Get in gear with the Zyn 10 Challenge and enjoy 10 smoke-free, spit-free days for just $5.95. Order online and start your new journey today. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.